So maybe you've noticed that most animals have the common decency to just be what they are. If you own a cat, for example, you've probably noticed that it doesn't have a self-help bookshelf and it's not worried about its legacy. It spends multiple hours a day staring at a moth, maybe swatting at it a few times, and it spends several hours napping, and the rest of the time it's essentially a furry tube for processing tuna. And when the cat eventually passes away, it doesn't leave behind some half-finished memoir or a sense of unfulfilled potential. It just stops. It's clean. But then there's us. You are a collection of atoms that somehow woke up this morning and put on some pants, and now you have to deal with the fact that you're gonna die, but you don't know when exactly. And you have rent, and your left knee makes a clicking sound that reminds you of the inevitable decay of your physical form. So, congratulations. You have human consciousness. This is the ultimate gift that nobody really asked for. And yes, it is an amazing thing. But it comes with a price that leaves many people questioning if it's worth it. So there is this concept in biology called hypertele. And it's basically when evolution gets just a little too enthusiastic. It's when a trait keeps growing past the point of being helpful until it becomes a straight-up hazard. So let's take the Irish elk, for example, which is now extinct. So this thing had antlers that spanned 12 feet. And yeah, it was certainly beautiful and majestic. But it was so heavy that the elk basically couldn't lift its head to eat or run away from anything with teeth. And it would regularly get itself stuck, therefore leaving it vulnerable. So another way to look at this is the Irish elk evolved itself into a corner because it grew an ostentatious crown that eventually crushed its own neck. Now, for a while, I have been wondering if our brains are the 12-foot antlers of the animal kingdom. Because we've basically outpaced our own utility at this point. And evolution gave us self-awareness because it helped us predict where the tiger might be hiding. But then eventually the tigers stopped being a threat, by and large, and the awareness stayed. So now, instead of predicting man-eating predators, we are predicting existential dread. Because in spite of all the fantastic things that we humans have accomplished, such as the ability to contemplate infinity, we are nonetheless trapped in a body that's essentially a wet bag of salt and meat that's slowly expiring. This is not a miracle so much as it is a design flaw. And we are the only creatures on planet Earth who spends the majority of its time trying to forget or ignore what it is. And we do this because we can't handle self-consciousness at this level. And this reminds me of a quote by Soren Kierkegaard. If mankind were a beast or an angel, he would not be able to be in a state of dread. But because he is a synthesis, he is able to be in dread. And the more profoundly he is in dread, the greater is the man. So Kierkegaard implies that we feel dread because we have the freedom to choose. And there's a sense of terror about that. Though, that freedom really is an illusion because free will doesn't actually exist. However, most of us believe in the illusion because we need to feel some sense of agency in our lives, even if it means feeling this underlying dread. We're the only species on the planet that needs a reason to get out of bed. And we're the only ones that can be physically healthy and have a full stomach and have a roof over our heads and still have this need and feel like we're drowning because we can't find the point. Evolution it's usually a fairly pragmatic process. It's about adaptation to a changing environment. It's about survival, and it's obviously about replication. It's a pretty straightforward, very brutal accounting system. Now, somewhere along the line, the ledger got messed up. And we grew these massive, bloated cerebral vortexes, these gray, wrinkly engines of why. And at that point, the game completely changed. At that point, we didn't want to just survive anymore. We wanted to know what survival was for. We wanted to know what the meaning of it was. And that's the cosmic joke right there, because there is no answer. So if you feel like life is some colossal, elaborate prank, you're in good company. Because there's a whole line of thinkers who looked at the human consciousness and they did not see a divine spark. They saw something like a biological catastrophe. So enter the Norwegian philosopher, Peter Wessel Zappa. Now, he wasn't exactly the life of the party. He argued that we are over-equipped and that we have this yearning for justice and meaning and permanence, but we live in a universe that provides exactly zero of those things. I mean, it's like being born with this deep spiritual hunger for food that doesn't exist. And Zappa wasn't alone, because there's a whole pessimist constellation of philosophers who all realize that consciousness doesn't actually solve suffering. It just gives you a front row seat to it with a high definition commentary. So they saw the will to live as this blind, stupid force that just wants to keep the meat moving in our brains. Our brains are the unlucky witnesses to all of this. Now, I realize this is a rather grim realization, because awareness doesn't actually make the world better. It just turns up the volume exponentially. So when you're a kid, you think that being an adult means you'll finally understand the point of everything. But then you get there and you realize everyone's just performing a role in a play, and it's a play that hasn't even been written yet. And we're all just trying to look busy so the universe doesn't notice that we have no idea why the hell we're here. So Zappa noticed that because this over-awareness is so painful, we develop these psychological defense mechanisms. The whole civilization has been built on what's essentially a giant, expensive pair of noise-canceling headphones for the soul. And we spend billions of dollars and trillions of hours just trying to dampen the signal of our own minds. So how are you supposed to survive being a biological heir? Zappa says we use what's called the four pillars of damage control. So the first one is isolation. This is the classic, just don't think about it. So this is the unwritten collective agreement that we all have to not talk about the fact that we're on a speck flying through a void, and that eventually everyone you love will be a memory, and then even the memory will be gone. So we push these scary thoughts into the basement of our minds, and then we drag a heavy rug over the door. And this is why we get uncomfortable when someone gets a little too real at a dinner party. Hey, pass the salt. And by the way, isn't it weird that we're all just ghosts driving meat robots? Yeah, nobody wants that guy at the table. And that's why I'm never at dinner parties. We want the guy who talks about the weather or the sports ball game. We, you know, prefer to isolate the cosmic horror so we can finish our Caesar salad in peace. Okay, so the second of these four pillars of damage control is anchoring. This is where we tether our wandering, terrified minds to something allegedly solid, like values, spirituality or religion, political parties, career goals, the brand. And what we do is build these walls of certainty around ourselves so we don't have to look at the abyss. And we say, I am a, insert identity here, and suddenly the world feels manageable somewhat. So in a manner of speaking, we've anchored ourselves to appear so that we don't drift out to sea. But the pier, it turns out, is rotting, and the sea is still there regardless. We just convinced ourselves that if we stare at the wood grain long enough, the ocean will disappear. All right. So now we move on to the third way that we keep the lights on. And this is a huge one these days. You may have guessed it. Distraction. So this is the one that we have more or less perfected. So Zappa called it the constant stream of impressions. So back in his day, it was probably the radio or the newspaper. And now, it's a black mirror in your pocket or in the palm of your hand that feeds you this customized slurry of outrage and I don't know, dancing teenagers every 6 seconds or whatever. And we've established a society that is, it's terrified of 5 minutes of silence. Now, why have we done this? Because in the silence, the antlers get pretty heavy. And this is where you remember that you are a temporary arrangement of matter. So, we distract. We scroll, we hustle our lives like we're trying to win a race where the finish line is, it's really just a hole in the ground. And we turn our hobbies into side hustles, and then we turn our side hustles into identities. And we do all this to avoid the quiet realization that we are essentially just killing time until time kills us. And then there's sublimation. This is the rather fancy one. So this is kind of what I'm doing right now. This is when you take all that cosmic dread and all that mistaken consciousness, and you turn it into a painting or a song or a YouTube video. And this one's probably the most honest of the coping mechanisms. Nonetheless, it's still ultimately a trick because we're still trying to make the tragedy look beautiful so we can, you know, live with it. We take the Irish elk's antlers and we attempt to turn them into a chandelier. And then we hope that nobody notices that the neck is still snapping. And then we tell ourselves that because we can write a poem about the void, that this makes the void somehow artistic. But it's not really. It's just empty. Though the poem makes the staying here a little more bearable. You know, what's funny is how much of this pessimism sounds like ancient spirituality if you look at it from a certain angle. So if you look at Zen, these things start to look like they come from the same place. They look at the thinking mind and they don't see a soul. They see a generator of suffering. They see a machine that produces I and me and mine until the organism is exhausted. But where the Western pessimists see a trap with no exit, Zen sees a trap that only works if you keep pulling the lever over and over. So the pessimists, like Schopenhauer, the original grumpy old man of philosophy, they lived on the bridge between these two worlds. So Schopenhauer read the Eastern text and he nodded along and he saw that the blind, hungry drive of the will, with its insatiable desire to keep existing, was ultimately the source of all the bullshit. And he saw that our consciousness was just a mirror reflecting a world of pain. So Schopenhauer's solution was to just stop wanting, to look at art or listen to music or become a monk and starve the will until it lets go of you. But he couldn't do it because he was too conscious. He got stuck in his own antlers. And he spent most of his life writing about how desire is a prison while living in a nice apartment and eating very well-prepared sausages. But he does prove the point that even when you know the brain is an evolutionary error, you still have to feed it. You still have to live inside the mistake. If we are being honest, the evidence for the evolutionary mistake thesis is pretty damning. I mean, look at the modern landscape. We've got more comfort than any humans in history, and yet we're popping pills just to feel baseline. And in our pockets, we have the sum of all human knowledge. And what are we doing with it? Well, we scroll the equivalent of the height of the Statue of Liberty every day. And then we use it to argue with strangers or bots about things that don't matter. Now, would consciousness really be this fragile if it was a finely tuned survival tool? A hammer, it doesn't get depressed because it thinks it's failing as a tool. A hammer just hits things. But we have a tool that's constantly questioning its own handle because we are a biological experiment that accidentally became aware of the laboratory. And now we are trying to pick the lock. But there is a counter argument. It's a slim one, but it's there. And it says that, look, maybe we aren't a mistake. We're just unfinished. Evolution hasn't stopped yet. Nature doesn't have a moral compass. It doesn't have kindness or mercy in its code. It just has win and lose, pass or fail. But we, the mistakes, we invented these concepts, and we took this bloated, overactive brain, and we used it to create something that nature never intended. Empathy for things that don't benefit us. We have the ability to look at another creature suffering and feel it in our chest. Now that's not useful for survival. It's actually a liability. But it's also the only thing that makes the meat grinder of existence feel like something other than a horror movie. And maybe we're the only way the universe gets to look in a mirror and say, wow, this is actually kind of a shit show, isn't it? So we are stuck in a body that's gradually breaking, with a mind that's far too big for its own good, in a universe that doesn't speak our language. And people look at this and they like to offer platitudes like, just stay positive. Or my favorite, everything happens for a reason. But that's just more Zapfian anchoring. It's noise. The reality is, there aren't really solutions to being a conscious accident. You can't fix the fact that you have this level of self-awareness. All you can really do is decide how you're going to carry that weight, how you're going to push that boulder. And one way is to just stop the denial. Stop pretending that if you just get the right job, find the right partner, or what have you, that the dread is going to disappear. It won't. The dread is just part of the hard, it's part of the hardware. Now, however, I do think that there's an intangible kind of power in just standing there and acknowledging this. Once again, radical acceptance. You're on a sinking ship, and you decide to keep playing the violin anyway. And it's not because your playing is going to stop the water. It's because you're a violinist. And what else are you going to do? I think we find this weird, gritty fortitude in the anyway. Now, I might be a mistake, but I'm going to drink this coffee anyway. And I know this is all temporary, but I'm going to be kind to this person anyway. So I think it's about moving away from this why is this happening? And moving toward, well, since this is happening, how or where do I want to stand? If the Irish elk is us, and our antlers are scraping the ceiling of every room we walk into, and it's heavy and awkward as hell, and it's probably a mistake, I don't know. I look at it like this. We might as well just get used to the view from the heights while we have it and while we're here. And there's just not much more I can say about it at this point in time. I guess that's all I got for today. As always, thanks for listening.